Session number 28766.
Anthony Duke, Reel 1. Could we start with when and where you were born, please?
I was born accidentally in St. Albans, because my father was going to see the day I was born, so he didn't see me for three weeks, I think. The ship sailed the next day. He was a merchant ship. So my mother was left to St. Albans, where her parents lived. And then I didn't get back to Suffolk, where I should have been born. Always regretted not having been born in my own county. And I didn't get back there for 3 weeks, I think. Those days, I suppose one had to go everywhere by train. It was end of 1920. I went to school, a little local dame school, really, I suppose you call it those days, and in the village with a dear old person who became a very great friend of ours, and I suppose time I was 6 or 7, I went to a day school in Sudbury, in Suffolk, and stayed there for till I was 11, and then went to the junior house at Woodbridge, also in Suffolk. And in due course, progressed up to school. So I've been there, I think, till 1938. That's about a year before war broke out.
Did you enjoy school?
The sport, yes. The ecclesiastical side, no. I wasn't really very clever at it. Neither was my brother, who was there for me. But anyway, we both became head of the school. We both became captain of all the sports, cricket, rugby. And we both, of course, joined the OTC, all the cadets, as they call them now, which in my day was compulsory. You weren't allowed to say, well, I don't want to join. You just did join. And he became company sergeant major, I think they call him, and I followed him about 3 years later. And I went into the Fleet Air Arm, rather through the back door. I knew I couldn't get through the Cranmore, because that was a competitive exam, they only took a limited number every year, or the Royal Navy, which I didn't particularly want. I had flown in five-bob or ten-bob flights with the local C.W.A. Scott was one, and the other one was who barnstormed around the country giving flights for 5 bob or 10 bob. I'm sorry, shillings. That convinced me that flying was the one I wanted. And
had that been your ambition throughout school?
Yes. To win the... And the idea of being in the Navy and flying was ideal. And I was accepted by the Navy in, I think it was about the 1st of November, 1938. But I had broken a collarbone in the first game of rugger. And so it was decided that rather than risk being refused on medical grounds, that I should go home and keep well clear of everything, not go and mess the collarbone up more than it was. I was strapped up in those days. They don't do that now, I don't think. And I think I went to the Frobisher, the training ship, and certainly didn't do any flying till the following May 38.
What did you
remember? May 39. And they were in Tiger Moss from Gravesend, which was then a civilian flying school run by Air Works Limited. And they had a contract with the Navy. Luckily, I had an extremely kind and instructor who was an ex-RAF short service chap. They were all mainly for short service chaps who had done their 4 years or 5 years short service and then were taken on as instructors. And flying Officer Higgins, who was my instructor, he never once got cross with anybody, which is a great thing. And some of the instructors were absolute so-and-sos. I mean, I'm sure one chap was chucked out from flying at that stage, because the instructor just got him so tangled up by shouting at him down this gadget. Well, no voice pipes we had, didn't have RT then. That he was all of a dither. And anyway, I got through that. We lived at Greenwich Naval College. Went up to the airfield at Gravesend by coach 8 o'clock every morning. And we stayed up there for lunch and tea. You did theory of flight and classworks in the morning and flew in the afternoon, or vice versa. Half flew in the morning, half flew in the afternoon. And I think we were there for 5 weeks, I think. And then we moved up to Peterborough in Norfolk. No, Peterborough in Northampton those days.
Could you just describe what the Tiger Moths were like to fly?
Pardon?
Could you just describe what the Tiger Moths were like to fly?
Oh, beautiful. If I get one here now, I'd have it. Didn't take you off, did it? I know. It was Stinson, you know. She was a wren, you see, and so on the same air station. Or should I say a wren also. And, yes, the Tiger Moth was great fun. And you could do anything in it. It was a wonderful aircraft for teaching anybody aerobatics. You didn't have to ask anybody where you went in those days. And my home was in Suffolk. So all I had to do was fly for half an hour and I was over home. And showing off to all the people in the village. I think the first time we went home, my instructor took me. And he decided that I didn't need telling where to go. I did fly over London Bridge. I did ask that permission then, and he said, well, you must stay well clear of the land on either side and stay well over the river. And so I suggest you didn't go any further than London Bridge and turn around and come back, which is quite, we thought that was quite an achievement. And my first solo was after 7 3/4 hours. It was just within the week. I suppose the average of about 7 7.5 hours, that sort of thing. And one chap went solo after 4 hours, but we discovered that he had been flying weekends anyway as a boy. Well, you know, his parents were fairly wealthy, I suppose, and they paid for him to be taught to fly, which was not a fair assessment. My first sailor was to London Aero Club in Hamworth, because my instructor had a friend there. And we went over there, we had lunch with his friend in the club, and came back in the afternoon. And that was the sort of thing you could do in those days, which made the training very much more fun than it might have been. After Peterborough, which we did on Hearts, Hawker Hearts, and Hawker Audax, which I think was the same thing, but it was produced for the Army Air Corps, they didn't call it the Army Air Corps, what do they call it? Army Corporation. They had Peterborough, we had 39 naval chaps, mainly midshipmen, but there were some older ones there. There was one or two Royal Marines. There was several ratings being volunteer for flying were allowed to start their training, and they were mainly petty officers and chief petty officers. We were there for to an end until Christmas, because we went up to Scotland for a week for air bombing, and we'd already done air-to-air firing, because there was a firing range off the Wash, and it was quite close to Peterborough, so you took it on a program of about a quarter of an hour to chase after a drogue being heaved by another aircraft. And the bullets had a bit of red paint on the tip. So when they hit the drogue, which was being pulled by safe distance by another aircraft, it left a red mark. And so they could assess your hits and misses. I suppose most chaps managed that all right. What did we do then? Oh, I came home and asked to go on leave almost immediately, because I'd been told a great aunt of mine had died, and the funeral was to be there a few days' time. And so they said, well, you're going on a change of course and Christmas Eve anyway in a few days' time, so there's no reason why you shouldn't go now. So I got away a few days early, and that was virtually the end of... we had to go out to the south of France to Ier, which is a French naval airfield. And that was the air base for the old Argus aircraft carrier, which survived the war, funnily enough. But she was sent down there as being a safe place for her to steam up and down the coast while we went out by train and did 7 deck landings each. And then back again. Well, it turned out that we took 2 or 3 days to get down there. And you can imagine... the train journey down was really quite interesting, but we had to spend 2 or 3 days in Paris, and on that occasion I remember I had all my wallet stolen. Some chap who spoke perfect English said he could get us tickets for the Folies de Bergère, I think, and he didn't come back. neither did my wallet. It was quite serious. Point of view, we were only getting 7 bob a day, 7 shillings a day, as midshipmen. I think we had another 4 bob flying pay once you qualified. Then what happened? We came back in a hurry because the Italians had come into the war quite suddenly. And in actual fact, they bombed the airfield, about the only airfield that Italians were capable of bombing, I think. It was only about 20 minutes flight from the Italian border. And the French were completely... well, you wouldn't have thought they were at war at all. I mean, they were actually, even from the outbreak of war on September the 3rd, we had dispersed our aircraft all around the local fields and against the wood, which which is now built over. I went up there some years ago and found the whole airfield was industrial area and office areas and so on. But then we could hide the aircraft with a minimum destruction of the wood every night, and pick them up again next day. We had an old van which went round dropping off crews wherever the aircraft happened to be. And of course, we all expected war to come on September the 3rd with air raid warnings going left, right, and center. We all went up onto the airfield to watch, but nothing happened. In fact, no bombs did drop, I don't think, until I believe one dropped in Auckland or something, and killed a sheep or something like that. But I mean, the Germans, I can never understand the Germans. Why didn't they seriously bomb the Fourth Bridge, which was the real communication between England and Scotland? Or even the road bridge wasn't there then, but they had another road bridge beyond Perth. They could have cut Scotland off completely, but they bombed it the first Sunday, and the next Sunday, all Edinburgh went out and sat in their cars and watched the next bombing, but nothing happened, and they never did bomb it again. There were dummy ships, converted merchant ships, made to look like battle wagons and cruisers and things, anchored seaward side of the Fourth Bridge, but whoever ordered them to be built them in Belfast in full view of the German consulate, and so they knew exactly what was going on, so they just didn't trouble to bomb them. Oh, they were taken away after a time. We had spent some little time in the Courageous, which was sunk first month of the war by submarine off the Scilly Isles, I think. she went down very quickly, but comparatively few losses of life. She was probably one of the biggest, I think she was, that and the Glorious were the sister ships, and they were the biggest carriers that we had. To lose one on the beginning of the war, and then I think the Hermes was sunk by the Japs as soon as they came in the war, and Eagle was sunk in the mid. Taking a convoy to Malta, and one or two of the escort carriers. We had 69 carriers by the end of the war, and we'd only lost 6, I think, which was a remarkable achievement. You would have thought that when war broke out, some of the old-fashioned sailors and commodores and convoys didn't want the aircraft carriers with the convoys because they thought they would attract U-boats. An extraordinary natural fact. I only received the other day a list of for a friend of mine of all the U-boats sunk in the Atlantic the Fleet Air Arm. And so they proved their worth. In fact, they wouldn't sail a convoy without a carrier. And highly successful.
What were the feelings of you and your colleagues when war first started?
Oh, excited. I remember going home and on that little leave I had just before Christmas to this funeral. And I was in the shop buying cigarettes and something other. And I said, I expect them to be over by next Christmas, more than 6 years later. No, we had a certain amount of excitement, I think. And we still had people. One instructor was flying the First World War. There were still people. There was an air gunner, I remember, Johnson, remembering well. He was at Zeebrugger, 1917, something like that, and was still flying. I think they gave him a very responsible job ashore after that. When they gradually built up. See, the Fleet Air Arm was very small then. I mean, there were only, I think there were only 60-odd air crews, and many of those were Air Force on loan. And courageous, even had a commander flying who was a wing commander. They gradually worked their way. Although we did have Royal Air Force flight sergeants and people who were very experienced, not because they wanted to, but because they were told to do it. I think they'd much rather have been back of the RAF and got rapid promotion. They didn't get very. I don't think they had a fair deal over that. There was a wing commander at Ballykelly in Northern Ireland who was a sergeant. With our flight sergeant, who told to serve in the Fleet Air Arm, and that sort of thing didn't go down very well. What then? I don't know. You ask me.
Could you describe a bit more about your operational training in terms of the torpedo dropping and deck landings and
stuff? Well, torpedo dropping. Was almost entirely sewed up at Gosport right through that first Christmas of the war. The runways they couldn't be cleared, and it froze every night. And finally, when it did clear, and we managed to get in a certain amount of dummy torpedo dropping off Stokes Bay, which is between Gosport and Southampton, I suppose you'd say, and it was used for dropping torpedoes with airheads which blew, and then they floated, and recovery vessels, mainly old trawlers and things, picked them up and brought them back. You weren't very popular if you dropped one of those from the wrong height and the wrong speed, and it wasn't recovered. I think I was responsible for one. I wasn't very popular, I can tell you. But I wasn't the only one. That went on for as long as we could, a very short period after the snow cleared and the runways and everything were clear. Low flying over the sea was an essential part of training for dropping torpedoes, because you mustn't drop them above about, I think, about 50 or 60 feet. What else was there?
What sort of speed would you have to be flying at?
Oh, well, the swordfish could, and the sharks, we also had sharks there. They could only fly at about, fully loaded, about 80 knots. Maximum speed, I suppose, for a stringback or swordfish was 90 knots downhill. But they survived the war, and they were the only aircraft, I believe, in any of the services which started the war operationally and finished the war operationally. They were still flying on the day, escorting a convoy up the East Coast, which they were ideal at. A boring job, ever there was one. But then they stuck at it. I remember a signal being sent from, I think it was Black Swan, which is a very famous destroyer in charge of a convoy, and you had to identify yourself as soon as you took over the patrol. There were four hour patrols, and from an hour before dawn to an hour after dark, and our patrol area was anywhere between Flamborough Head, where we handed over to and Northern Squadron, and Orford Ness. And the average speed of a convoy was the speed of a slow ship, which was probably about 10, 12 knots or something on a slow convoy. And there again, I don't know why the Germans didn't use torpedo boats and things to when they knew that there was only one aircraft guarding them. When they were in bomb alley, as they call it, from Dover to, I don't know what the southern tip was, but it was a channel that was called bomb alley, and they used a tremendous amount of dive bombing and so on. It was a very dangerous part to be in. We were never in that. What else you want to